trumpet man from old Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowin' reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot de la da toot, he blows it eight to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
This December 3rd marks the 30th anniversary of one of the most shattering events of Oakland's history, the General Strike of 1946. But don't look for any parades, commemorations, or exhibits at the museum. It's an event that our conservative city government would rather forget. Not only would they like to forget it, but they would like us to forget this chapter and many others in the people's history of this city. But the fandoms of thousands of working people out in the streets, thronging in the downtown areas, tying up traffic, skirmishing with the police, should be remembered. For 54 hours, over 100,000 workers from 142 AFL unions shut down Oakland. All public transportation, construction, hotels, restaurants, deliveries, theaters, newspapers, and stores were closed. Essential services such as hospital deliveries continued, but the absence of all buses and streetcars and taxis closed the schools and clogged the Bay Bridge with a massive traffic jam. But 30 years isn't that long ago. Many of the participants and leaders of the strike are still alive, and some are still working. These people have stories and accounts of the strike that have not been published and are not widely known. Bay City Blues contacted some of these trade unionists and asked their impressions of the events that took place in Oakland in December 1946. Oakland, late fall 1946. The war is over and an uneasy peace hovers over the country, clouded by the return of U.S. hostilities against the Soviet Union. American working people had fought first the Great Depression and then the World War, and felt entitled to a share in the war-inflated prosperity that had set record-breaking profits for businesses. Joe Chaudet of the International Typographical Union, an editor of the East Bay Labor Journal in that period, gives his sense of the mood of the country.
Well, I think the general labor situation at that time, it was kind of in a state of flux, because we had all of the young fellows coming back from the war that had fought for their country. Peace had been declared. They came on back and they were looking for jobs. The economy started to move up, but there was a great deal of unrest because of the fact that after all these people had come out of a lot of turmoil, the veterans had come out of a lot of turmoil, shooting. They saw their friends get killed and everything else, and they came back with the idea, well, I want to remake the world. You know, I mean, this is just my feeling about it, you ask, and that's just about it. But there was a great deal of unrest. We're not going to take it anymore. In a lot of respect, you know, we're going to try and build a better America, but by God, we're not going to take any more guff in trying to build this. And I think that this was one of the things that happened in 46 and also in later years. We saw that after the Vietnam War, during the Vietnam War, with these people saying, look, I've done my part. I think I paid my dues as an American citizen. I want my fair share.
There had been a business-labor truce during most of the war, and the militant labor movement of the 30s was in mothballs. For business, 1946 seemed the ideal time to roll back the gains made by labor in the New Deal period. The drive for the open shop was started again, and workers sensed a continued determination of business to keep a lid on salaries while raising prices instantly once wartime profit controls were lifted. Organizing drives were treated with layoffs and lockouts. Joe Chaudet.
Look, they were all billionaires or millionaires. Look at Kaiser. Look at Henry J. Kaiser, a multi-billionaire. Look at all of the shipbuilding. Look at the airplane factories. Look at all of that. They made it all. Then when these people came on back, and I mean, you know, my brother Americans, and also the gals that came back from the war, and when they held out their hand for just a little piece of pie, the answer was no. The answer was no completely. We're not going to have unionization. It was all right during the war, but no more. No more. We had to do it. We had to sign a contract with the government for fair employment. We had to sign a contract because of the fact that they were in the driver's seat. Now we're in the driver's seat. And they had no more sympathy for those people coming back than the man in the moon. Look, the only thing that they're were interested in and still are is the almighty buck.
This offensive by business was met by a record-breaking strike wave in 1946. 5,000 strikes involving over 4.5 million workers marched out in coal, auto, railroads, utilities, communications, and municipal government. Food prices rose by 28% in the last 6 months of 1946, and corporate profits were higher than in the peak years during the war. Wages, on the other hand, were lower than in 1940, and in addition, women had a special reason to be concerned with the labor situation, as Joe Chaudet explains.
I think the war gave an impetus to women for their individual freedom and individual right to be a wage earner. And, you know, what was the song, Rosie the Riveter? You know, what they did. And if it hadn't been for the women, I don't think we'd have ever won a war. And I think that after the war, it was just a question of this I want mine. You know, I want to live like a free human being. I want some dignity, and I think that that's one of the reasons that they turned to the labor movement and to get organized. These women were used to paychecks, you know, and they were out and they were free and they were working and they realized what money meant because before the old man took care of that, you know, in a lot of respects, he was the wage earner. But these women got out, they got a sense of freedom, they belonged to unions, whether they liked them or not, you know. But nevertheless, the wages were good, the overtime was good, they made good money. So then, after the war was over, the balloon kind of burst, the shipyards closed. Where else to go? Department stores. Being waitresses, working in department stores, doing these very various things. And so I think this is one of the reasons that they tended to not flock toward it, but they tended to look upon the department stores and this more or less genteel labor as an open field.
Al Kidder was an employee of Kahn's, one such department store in downtown Oakland.
1946 is when the organizing campaign was put forth, and it was during the period of July and August. At that time, they were trying to organize in the department store field in Oakland. Kahn's and Hastings were picked because at that time it was felt that the people wanted to join the union, wanted to have a union in there to represent them. Well, when the company found out about the organizing within the store, what precipitated the strike was the firing of one of the people who had joined the union. One of the ladies who had joined and signed up with the union was fired. And the strike took place in, I believe it was October the 8th, or October anyway. Right in that time, because my son was born the 8th of October, and I know we just got on a strike. So that's one of the things that keeps that memory open. That was on Kahn's, right.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened with Hastings?
Hastings followed suit right after that.
What were the conditions at these two stores that made people want to join the union?
Well, we were fighting the old conditions. I can remember when my mother worked in downtown Oakland, the department stores, and they had what they called the ready room, that a woman would go down at 8 o'clock in the morning and sit there with the hope all day long of being called to a department and getting 2 or 3 hours work in. And this is the type of things you were finding in a department store in those days, before the war, during the Depression, right after the Depression, you'd just go down and just hope that maybe some department wouldn't have enough people there, or they had a busy day so they'd need somebody for a couple of hours, you'd get a couple of hours work in. And this is why, basically, a union was needed. I was working in the shoe department, and I was making, $28 a week at that time. And, you know, just getting out of the service and not having really something you could call a background of where to go to work. we had union shoe stores right around cons. And, you know, working in the area, you invariably talk to people in the other stores, and I found out the union stores were making in the area of around $42 a week. And all I could think of was the fact that if we got the union there, I'd make 42 instead of 28. And I think this was basically the reason for all the people.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter'll be the straw boss then.
In their attempts to organize, Conn's and Hastings employees were up against more than just their own management. The business community of Oakland was strongly united in its efforts to prevent unionization. This business establishment was led by the Oakland Tribune and its publishers, Joseph Noland and his son, William Noland. The Tribune had long been known for its virulent stance against labor, minorities, communists, real or imagined, and progressive thought in general. These same forces headed up a coalition of the Chamber of Commerce, Kaiser Industries, and the Retail Merchants Association, or RMA, the representative of the department stores, as well as the local government. The RMA played a key role in the events that led up to the strike.
What was the Retail Merchants Association and Conn's and Hastings' response to the organizing drive after the war?
Well, their response to any organizing drive by any organized labor movement was do everything in their power to keep it from happening.
Al Kidder.
The Retail Merchants Association, RMA, has changed over the years, but this was their policy back in those days, that you couldn't have a union contract and be a voting member. And that was prior to the Taft-Hartley.
Although the clerks' union had enrolled over half of the Conn's and Hastings workers, the employers represented by the Retail Merchants Association contended that all 28 stores in the association must be unionized in order for the union to be recognized as the proper bargaining agent for any of their stores. Joe Chaudet.
I mean, the unit to be organized was all of the stores in the Retail Merchants Association. So they went on out and they got these mom-and-pop stores. Well, a mom-and-pop store is not going to vote for union organization. What does it mean? There's no way, if they'd have thrown in every union organizer in the United States of America in Oakland, there's no way they're going in and organize every mom-and-pop store that have all the relatives working, you know?
What was the clerk's response?
The clerk's response was, it's impossible. And when this came down, and this is, I think, one of the things that led to the strike there.
Al Kidder.
The strike was called, and the picket lines were put out, and everything, more or less, we had the full cooperation of the entire labor movement. Yeah, there was all sorts of moves to get the pickets off, to limit the number of pickets, to keep you a certain distance from the doors, to 4 pickets to a door, 3 feet in the doorway, continuous moving, couldn't stop, you had to keep the pickets moving at all times. These were little harassing efforts by the company to make it more and more difficult to continue the picketing, to make it effective. Now, we had problems, but we never had anything that really got completely out of hand until the time that the general strike happened.
How effective was the picket line in preventing people from shopping at Conn's and Hastings?
It was very effective, really. Percentage-wise, I couldn't tell you that, but I do know that it was effective enough to make the company do everything in their power to get us off. Originally, we had somewhere in the area of between 70 and 80% of the workers came out. And I would say the same thing applied at Hastings. The company hired people to work behind the picket lines. There's no question about that. I mean, they got people to man the stores.
With Teamsters Local 70 refusing to cross clerk picket lines, Conn's and Hastings were running short on merchandise, badly needed for an expected profitable Christmas season.
Well, we'd had rumors going off and on for several weeks that they were going to bring in merchandise from Southern California through this trucking outfit. We had pickets on, or somebody watching the store 24 hours a day at that point to make sure nothing was going to happen. And then we had the Teamsters along with ourselves were watching all of the trucking outlets to see, and then they had people out on the highways watching for the trucks coming up. So actually we had it pretty well covered as far as trying to see whether or not these trucks were coming in.
Bob Ash, Secretary of the Alameda County Central Labor Council at the time of the strike.
Chief of Police Bob Tracy called me and told me that he had been informed. He'd been in a meeting in the then District Attorney's Office, Ralph White, with other city officials and with a committee from the Merchants Association, where they had laid the plans out to bring these scab trucks in from Los Angeles to make the deliveries. And so we had an agreement, an understanding, I guess you'd say, with the chief of police as to the way we would handle the picketing when they brought the trucks in. And then when I heard this was going to happen, why, I had a meeting with some Teamster officials down at Local 70's office. And at that meeting with the two international union officials there, we told them what we had been told to the chief of police and that we wanted to stop them if we could. And we were told that anything that we did to stop these scab trucks, they were having trouble with them in L.A., to stop these trucks and make it hard for them, well, they would support us. They would help us over that. And with the understanding of Tracy, how we were going to use our cars to park our cars along the street, around the front of the two stores, and particularly the side there at Conn's, where the loading dock was. And so we did that.
According to Ash, Police Chief Tracy informed the union that they could legally park their cars in the marked loading zones around Conn's and Hastings on the weekend. This action would effectively block deliveries to the two stores. Tracy also agreed to let Ash accompany him as he frisked professional scab truckers for weapons that they were expected to carry.
But I'd say around 3 o'clock that morning, that Sunday morning, when Tracy got a hold of me or sent a word over there at the picket line, wanted to see me, then went over. And he says, we're going out to convoy the trucks in now. And he says, let me make a phone call to be sure that the arrangement's been made. He says, who's going to go? And I said, I'll go. So he said, the phone, I don't know who he talked to, I have the least idea. He talked to somebody, and he hung up, turned around to me, and he said, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I said, I've got orders that nobody's to be there except the police. So I went back over to picket line. By the time I got back over there, the cops are pushing our people off the street and towing the automobiles away.
Joe Chaudet.
No one can ever convince me that, you know, the program wasn't set. Now nobody can come in with the chief of police of Oakland riding an open car with Paul St. Cyr, head of the United Employers, with Joe Nolan sitting there, with Bob Tracy there, with the chief of police leading the way on a motorcycle, or Wyman Vernon, it seems to me, was his name, leading the way. Maybe he was driving, bowing to the populace, coming right down through all of the people that were out there, bowing, the streetcars at that time were stopped, bowing right, left, and by God, they were going to put the labor movement in its place. No one can ever convince me that this thing didn't have to be so well planned, because we didn't find out until later on that all of the stuff that they moved in, all of the merchandise that moved in, was stored out in Hinks and Berkeley. You know, you'd have thought it was conquering heroes coming home from the war. These fellas, the only thing that was missing, they didn't wear top hats. The police had done their job the night before when they beat us all out of the alleys. Pushed us with those damn billy clubs. I was black and blue here for months. And they all marched over. I don't want to use the expression, in Prussian goose steps. But it was damn near that, when they all marched over and walked right on down the alley, pushed all of the pickets out, because we had heard that this was going to happen. Pushed us down the alley, pushed us back, pushed us out to 17th Street, pushed us all the way down to Broadway Franklin, pushed us down to there, pushed down to 12th Street, set up machine guns right in the middle of the square, facing Conn's, right in the middle of the square, had all of the cops just taking their billy clubs, shoving you this way, bumping you, hitting you in the throat, doing any damn thing just to get you out, pushed all of the labor people out of the alleys down the street, put out a cordon right around Cons, right around Cons and Hastings. Then all of a sudden the parade started. The only thing, as I say, they missed was top hats and a brass band. And there they rode, right straight down Telegraph Avenue, right on up. The trucks followed right behind them, went on in and unloaded. Then they went back to get more. By that time, the streetcars were stopped due to the Carmen's Union. They weren't going through the picket lines.
As picket captain, Al Kidder was present at the scene and witnessed one of labor's first reactions to the police activity.
The way it came about is that they cordoned off the 8 square blocks, and Al Brown, I think it was Al Brown was his name, was the head of the Carmen's local at that time. The streetcars were still running on Broadway. And he came down Broadway in a streetcar. And the police were out there, and they had Broadway blocked off. And he came up to the blockade, and the cop said, "It's all right, you can take your streetcar through." And he said, "Well, what's the deal?" They told him what they were doing, and he said, "Well, no, I consider this a police picket line, and I've never crossed a picket line in my life, and I'm not about to now." So he climbed out, he took the controls out of the streetcar, climbed out of the streetcar, and that was it. That was the spark that started the whole thing at that particular time, because every streetcar backed up behind him. They couldn't move his streetcar. He told the buses to stop, and they had an emergency meeting, and for 3 days, just about, nothing turned in Alameda County.
Joe Chaudet.
It wasn't bringing in strike breakers necessarily that started the general strike. You know, I thought about that a lot since that. We'd seen strike breakers. But the thing was using the police force that we were paying taxes for to beat us off our own streets. We couldn't even walk down the main street of Oakland. Now, this is the first step toward fascism.
Bob Ash is part of the Central Labor Council. Remembers the union leadership's reaction to the events of the day.
Then following that, we rounded up all of the Labor Council Executive Board members that were down there and had a meeting Sunday morning and decided what to do. And at that meeting, James Marshall, the president of Local 70, the Teamsters Union, said that Monday morning the Teamsters were not going to roll. They were going to stop all the trucks from going. And that if we didn't go along with him, why, we knew what we were. We were chicken. So we prevailed upon Marshall to hold it up until Tuesday till we could get all of the executive boards of the local unions to fill in with the council into a meeting. We had the meeting, sent wires to all of them. We had them in Monday morning. And at that meeting, the vote was taken that we hit the streets. Other than one, why, it was a loud, unanimous vote. We didn't call it a general strike, we called it a work holiday. Hit the street, so we let her go. We went out, shut it down on Tuesday morning.
In 1946, the AFL and CIO were separate and sometimes antagonistic labor organizations, with the CIO representing the more radical and the AFL the more conservative wing of the labor movement. In Oakland, CIO unions represented workers at the docks, utilities, and some factories. On December 2nd, the day before the general strike, they publicly offered their support to the efforts of the clerks and the AFL.
At this initial planning of the general strike, what was the possibility of CIO participation raised?
None. None at all.
Joe Chaudet.
The thing was, we'll do this ourselves. At that time, they had two different camps, in the left wing and the right wing in the CIO. Not the right wing. The left wing and the CIO regulars, you know, the steel workers and a few of that. But none at all. They tried to horn in the left wing, and they were told, get out. Get around, get away. We don't want any part of you. Don't even hang around the fringes. We want none of you.
What was the reason for that?
Because of the fact that right away you're licked. because right away the Tribune comes out. You had a headline down there, General Strike. Right away, if we'd have picked up a couple of those unions in the CIO, we'd have... The commies are running it. It's a commie general strike. It was never... At no time was there a tinge of it. At no time, Craig, was there even a breath of it. And we didn't want them around.
How did the word get out? How do you call a general strike?
We got on the radio and announced that as of whatever time it was, Tuesday morning, you know, we were on a general strike on a work holiday.
Bob Ash.
And all the unions got their business representatives to go out and start notifying the people. It was in the newspapers, of course, and everybody knew it was down. There wasn't much programming to it except to let's go, and we did it.
Joe Chaudet.
Complete, utter, planned chaos. What are you doing in general strike? There have been, what, four? This was the fifth in the country, or there have been seventh. Well, I don't know. What do you do? I'll never forget Harry Lundberg, who was head of the Seamen's Union, you know. He says, you guys run a general strike like a bunch of amateurs. Who knows how to run a general strike, you know? There's no planning. There's no nothing. What we did, we shut the town down, period. And as far as some of the most ludicrous things that happened, some guy came down and made a plaintiff plea on knees before some committee that they appointed because he had a load of Christmas trees going and he couldn't get them shipped. You know, in fact, there wasn't even elevators running in the Hotel Leamington. People had to walk all the way up the top of the Hotel Leamington. There was no elevators running, union elevators, you know, where they had the union operators under the Building Service Employees Union. Nothing was running. And grocery stores down, ground to a halt. You couldn't buy gas. The streetcars weren't running. The Tribune didn't publish. The Post and Enquirer didn't publish. I was president of the Typographical Union at that time, the Printers Union. They didn't publish a blooming thing for during the length of the strike. I mean, it was a complete shutdown of a city. Nothing was being delivered. Restaurants were closed. I think that's one of the reasons it had to end, because everybody was getting hungry. And when the paper doesn't come, what happened? You know, what's happened? You know, and then the people of the city of Oakland realized that this was a serious thing. And I think that that swung public opinion to our side. I think they were on the side of the strikers. Because when they walk out, there's no paper there, and there's just a few radio stations, and all they're screaming all day long is a general strike, but that paper's not there to give their biased side of the story, you know, to get their pitch in. Then the people, you know, have to think, well, look, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye, and I think that this is one of the things that made a success out of that general strike.
Dan Brough, a clerk and warehouse worker and photographer for the East Bay Labor Journal at the time of the strike, was on the streets and describes the atmosphere of the 6,000 to 10,000 people around the stores.
The only word I can think of is militant. They were very, very militant in their desire to bring the thing to a conclusion as speedily as possible with the least amount of actual property damage or physical damage to anybody involved. The strikers and the leaders kept harping on peaceful picketing and a peaceful atmosphere, but you cannot maintain a peaceful atmosphere when you're attacked by the opposition physically. You're going to have to fight back, or you're going to get an awful lot of lumps. There was not only masses of union people, but there were a great many of the strike breakers, the hired strike breakers that were hired to mingle with and create dissension out on the streets. If they could destroy my camera, they would have done it. I don't recall any incident of actual rioting per se. Yes, there were multiple altercations and actual physical contact when there was a group from the employers who ran in a rat pack. Well, then, yes, the people on the street assembled in like numbers or possibly a little more to take care of the situation, but it was not promulgated by the man on the street. It was by the hired strike breakers, the only thing I can call them, the Teamsters. After the incident of the trucks, they did have patrolling squads that would try to come in and break up these things before the police arrived, because in each case, when the police got there, they'd arrest the pickup and let the person who actually started the whole thing and was the responsible party and would let them go off scot-free.
Joe Chaudet.
Everybody was marching around. They had a band down there or something. It just was chaos, that's all. Nobody knew, no direction, no nothing, you know. And nothing was moving. Where else are you going to go? Well, the theaters were down, restaurants were down. What are you going to do? Everybody was having a good time, but the crowd was good. Nothing unruly. I didn't see any liquor, didn't see any. Well, where could you buy it? It was a holiday mood. It was a feeling of comradeship. And I think that this is one of the reasons that the veterans that had come back from the war, you know, it was kind of a throwback to their days, you know, when they were in the service, which hadn't been too long ago. And it was the feeling that, well, we're all together in this thing, you know. And it was a good, warm, healthy feeling. It was more like what this country should be. I mean, that is the feeling that I had. So it was an orderly, but I mean, the noise and everything else, you know, and cheering and running, and everything, you know. This union's out, this union out, that's on, rah, 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 you know, that was it. And then all of the wild rumors, you know. Hear this, hear this, hear this, forget it. Don't pay any attention to rumors. They realized, you know, what they had done. You know, we did this, nobody else. And that's a good feeling. We did this, and we'll call the shots, you know. And it was real good. But during it, there were several meetings at the Athens Club with all of the big wigs in Oakland and the Downtown Merchants Association. My God, you'd have thought, oh, the tears were so, you know, wrecking the city of Oakland and everything else. Nothing could wreck the city of Oakland, especially something like that. But it was humorous. It was humorous. But Oakland never suffered as much from the general strike as they have from the stupidity at City Hall. With it all, if we had a general strike every 3 or 4 years, they'd never do the damage that the backward thinking at City Hall by the city officials have done to this potentially the greatest city, one of the greatest cities in the United States.
Al Kidder.
As I say, I was a picket line captain. I was the captain of the pickets. I set up schedules. I ran the pickets around the store. I was there probably for the better part of 2 days during the mass picketing, trying to keep some semblance of order and trying to keep a picket line going, which was basically ridiculous because you didn't need a picket line with all those people there.
Well, there was a regular picket line along with the crowd of people.
Yeah, we had our regular picket schedule set up, and the people were still picketing.
Anybody try to go through?
Very, very few. Very few. In fact, I think the doors were locked the biggest part of the time, if I recall correctly. But, you know, you just don't let something like that go. You try to keep a semblance of order by saying, okay, we keep our picket line going. We don't know what's going to happen. Because this was something that nobody expected. Of course, being a neophyte into the labor movement, I felt that was a normal procedure, that this would happen all the time. I didn't think anything different about it. Now, boy, these guys are strong.
The first night of the general strike, a mass meeting was held at the Oakland Auditorium. 10,000 rank-and-file union members piled into the hall to hear what the labor leaders had to say, while 5,000 more stood outside in the pouring rain, listening to the meeting over a hastily set-up loudspeaker. Al Kidder was there.
Yeah, I think the feeling there was completely behind the general strike and behind the effort that was being put forth. I think they had probably one of the finest show of solidarity that the labor movement could ask for. But there again, as I say, it's something you can't plan. It's something that happens. And it was. It was a solid solid group of people there that were, they weren't out there to say, let's get this over with or knock off this foolishness. It was, let's get this thing squared away and let's get these people to understand that we're here and we're going to be here and we're going to be out until it does happen.
part of the Central Labor Council, Bob Ash was a member of the committee that negotiated with the city government and business interests.
We met at least four times in the 2 days by the committee that supposedly a citizens' committee, but they were all, most of them were affiliated with the downtown store at Capwell's and the rest of them down there. Really was the negotiating committee of the merchants, along with Paul St. Schur. By that time, my Jack Hassler had been appointed city manager, and he was in the meetings. Other than the merchants and Paul St. Schur, there was Joe Nolan was a member of the committee, and we met almost continuously for those 2 days. And at one time, we thought we had it settled. During the first meeting versus the second meeting, we were discussing it, and Nolan asked, if we had people signed up, organized, members of the union. And we said yes. He wanted to know how many. They told him. He wanted to know how many clerks that employed at Conn's and at Hastings, and the store management told him how many. And Nolan said, well, let me say something. He says, if anybody comes into my place and says that they represent a majority of the, shows me they represent a majority of the employees of the Oakland Tribune, I'll negotiate with them. And St. Schur called a recess in a hell of a big hurry. Went out and come back about 20 minutes later, Nolan not with him, and Nolan didn't send in another meeting. I think if there had been some clearer heads there, more willingness rather on the part of the merchants to start doing a little bit of negotiating to try to get the thing settled right, the thing wouldn't have lasted more than just the first few hours that first day.
Were there any reservations on the part of any of the union leaders about a general strike?
Oh, some.
Joe Chaudet.
Some. Some of the Teamsters. There were a couple of the Teamsters were a little, it began to bubble up over the neck. Some of them were a little timid about it. But I was told it was a telegram from Tobin, from the Teamsters, and Dave Beck, who was on his way up as heir apparent to Dan Tobin, get back to work and knock off this stuff. And, they all those pie cards that were making all the money, they tried to get into the act, and they were all in, they were appalled at the thought of their people going out on strike on, a simple measure like strike breaking and having your people driven off the streets.
What happened at the final negotiations?
Bob Ash.
I think we were close up until the time that by that time Minor Moon was in there representing Beck, and we'd been in all afternoon in the city manager's office, our committee and the so-called Citizens Committee, discussing the general strike, and sometime late in the afternoon, Moan got a phone call. He went out to take it and came back in and motioned for me to come out with him. So I went out there, and he was on the phone with Beck. He told me, he says, take the other line, and Beck repeated what he'd apparently been telling Moan to send the, all the local 70 officers and all the Teamsters officers and tell them to put the drivers back to work the next day. And Moan argued with him, asked him, told him he thought that we were well on the way to settling the dispute, that if he would hold up the order for another couple of hours, he was sure that we would settle it. And Beck told Moan that he would. We both hung up, went back in the room, and lo and behold, we walked in there, and the first newspapers delivered in the East Bay since the general strike started. Here are all the management people sitting there reading the newspapers, San Francisco Chronicles, saying that Beck had ordered the Teamsters to go back to work.
Joe Chaudet.
Number one, when I talk about Dave Beck, who are you talking about? You're talking about a man that made millions, went to prison and everything else. He never really represented his union. I mean, the way it should be represented. Here they were, the greatest organization of people, and Beck was a, but, well, I think that the, some of the retail merchants associations got a hold of Beck, and then he started putting the juice on them. And then the Charlie Real, who was head of the Teamsters, was in direct communication. Number one, he was a Republican, and he was in their pocket. And so he wired home that he'd come home and settle it for $10,000 or $15,000, I forget which. He was finally thrown out of the Teamsters Union for stealing so much money.
What else led to the end of the general strike?
It was a question, too, of the Downtown Merchants Association. Mr. Nolan and the people down at the courthouse realizing, well, look, you know, we got a bear by the tail. What the hell do we do? And so we had several meetings. We met up the Athens Club two or three times. And finally, it just came down to the point that I think it runs its course. But like anything else, general strike peters out after a few days. You know, what are you going to do? They start boom like that. Everyone started. The one in San Francisco started the shooting of two people. This one started over knocking us off the streets. One or two around the country started with the killing of a person or something like this, and this is the way they all start. But who knows how to run a general strike? I've never seen a formula or a book or anything that can tell exactly how you run a general strike. It happens, boom, and that's it. And then all of a sudden it peters out, period. It runs its course. However, this is one of the things between Bob Ash and I that we disagreed to until the day, the last night of the settlement. The CIO notified us that if it went past Thursday, that they'd shut off lights and power. And I wanted to continue it one more day and shut off the lights and power. And then we'd have had the whole ball of wax. And Bob Ash, he prevailed, and Galliano prevailed. And we went back to work, I think, on Thursday morning, or Friday morning, whatever the day was. Bob Ash and I still disagree to this day. Now he says, Joe, you were right. He says, we'd have had it all. Because that would have been a general strike. You know, that would have been a general strike. I think old Nolan, the minute all the lights went out in the Oakland Tribune, would have been over there. I don't think he even had to pick up. He'd have picked up the phone and call him and says, you're no longer a city council, when we'd have turned the city completely around. I think we'd have had every resignation up there of all of the stupid city council. We had the faceless men. We'd have had it. Okay? And then we would have been able to sit down and say, well, this is what we want. There's five resignations up there. There's seven resignations, whatever. We'll take one or two, or we'll take this, say. And this is when I think that we'd have made some good, solid gains as far as the labor movement was concerned. But once we lost that position, you know, of not being in a general strike, you know, how do you capture it again?
What did it feel like once the strike was over?
It was just a question, well, look, we've shown them, you know. Without getting everything, all of the little points down in writing, we've shown them we did it, you know, and we're satisfied with it.
Did unions get a firm commitment from the city that the police wouldn't be used to aid strike breaking?
Yes. It was not a firm commitment, but this was one of the understandings that they wouldn't be used to, you know, to break strike, which, you know, they didn't sign anything, but the next day, if they'd had to use the police, they'd have done it, so they weren't kidding anybody.
At 11 a.m., Thursday, December 5th, 1946, the general strike officially came to an end. But the workers at the two department stores were still out on strike, as Al Kidder explains.
We were still on picket, on strike. We were still picketing. We just kept right on going until finally, after the first of the year, when the interim agreement was finally reached with the Retail Merchants Association and Conn's and Hastings. And as far for all practical purposes, it was strictly nothing as far as the union contract, it didn't give union security, it didn't give us anything, really. And we weren't able to get a contract into there until 1954, when we went back and started organizing again.
The final settlement of the Collins-Hastings labor dispute didn't come till several years later, as Bob Ash explains.
When Mr. Riley, John Riley, the president of that chain, got a hold of me, and we met for a full, almost a whole day, like a cops and robbers thing, he called somebody that I knew that called me and made an appointment, and I was to meet him at the corner of Telegraph and Grand Avenue. He'd drive up in a Cadillac, a black Cadillac, and I was to get in. We'd go someplace and talk. We were out there, in a restaurant in Walnut Creek area for almost a whole day discussing it, discussing what to be done. Mr. Riley told me that he wasn't going to be the whipping boy for the Merchants Association again, and he knew that they were going to had a chance of organizing the people, and they wanted to sign an agreement to live with, and he withdrew from the association at that time. And as a result of that meeting, the clerks then got their first good agreement. So the general strike has something to do with it.
Another aspect of the outcome of the strike was the city council elections of May 1947. Labor organized a slate of candidates to oppose the incumbents. The CIO unions were particularly active in the Alameda County AFL-CIO political coalition. The unions, aligned with the Oakland Voters League, an independent organization, supported a platform of progressive policies. These included a restructuring of the city tax system, government neutrality during strikes, rent control, and an overhaul of the public health services. Also supported by the Negro Labor Committee, four of the five labor-backed candidates were elected. The fifth, Ben Goldfarb, probably lost due to anti-Semitism and a misleading layout of the ballot, which made his opponent appear as part of the labor slate.
This showed the temper of the people of the city of Oakland when they threw out those faceless men.
Joe Chaudet.
They realized what had been done to their city. And we carried on a campaign, and it was a good campaign, a solid campaign. We had people out working, pushing doorbells, but we did a job, which showed the temper of the people of the city of Oakland. They realized that the labor movement was right, because they supported us. Whoever won before in Oakland, all Mr. Nolan had to do was push a button, and he could elect any faceless man that he wanted to.
What would you say then, the general strike and the resulting political activity did for labor unity in Oakland?
I think it was one of the greatest things that ever happened. It gave the whole labor movement, Craig, an impetus. We showed what could be done in two successive years. We showed by the general strike, if you hang together, you can take anybody on. And by the election, we came that close, you know. If we'd had a guy by the name of O'Brien, we'd have run it all.
Dan Bro.
For quite a period of time, there was a labor unity that was hard to penetrate after the general strike. Like most things, time developed an apathy, and there has been a general chewing on one another. The Teamsters pulled out of the AFL-CIO, of course. The Teamsters, under one administration, went on a pirating binge where they were trying to take over other jurisdictions. Situation developed where other unions were doing the same thing.
The Teamsters, there's some parallels between, you know, their activity in 1946 and activity today still.
It comes right from the top on down. It's just that simple.
Of course, there's different leadership today than there was, at least the individuals involved today are different than they were 30 years ago.
In 46, as I remember, the head of the Teamsters was Dave Beck. After he was sent to prison, then Jimmy Hoffa took over. And when he was sent to prison, Fitzsimmons took over. These three men were, I think, pretty closely associated, and their thought processes were pretty similar. So, although there was a different individual on the stationery as head of the organization, I don't think the policies would change too much. You had a militant labor movement in the 40s. It was actually, I think, a carryover from the 30s when you had Wrinkles in Your Belly and the chow lines and general degrading situation of the Great Depression. And things, of course, picked up a little bit in the war years. So they no longer had the wrinkles in their bellies, but they still had the militancy that had been developed in the 30s.
I think that people have forgotten all about the Depression.
Joe Chaudet.
Except us that went through it. They don't remember what we went through in the 30s to get that. Striking, and getting the hell kicked out of us in some respects, and going to bat because we knew that eventually it would pay off for us. Possibly it was selfish in those days, but yet, nevertheless, it was a fight.
It's not as it is today, where they've had things soft for a long time, and there's an apathy, at least in my opinion, growing among the rank-and-file union member, because they think that this situation that they're enjoying was brought on by altruism on the part of the employers, and we who went through the Depression and went through the general strike and have fought for the rank-and-file member for a lifetime. We know better that there's no altruistic or benevolent employer. He'll take every ounce of blood that he can get out of you and then tie a can to you when you have outlived your usefulness. Even the better employers are that same way, to perhaps a lesser degree than the heartless giant corporations.
Do you think the idea of a general strike seems a lot more out of place today, a lot more unlikely than it was back in 46, right after the war?
No, I think a general strike could happen today just as easy as it did then.
Al Kidder.
What you have to do is to find the spark that creates the condition that would cause a general strike to happen. And there is no way, I don't think, that anyone could go out today and say, well, now, if I wanted to call a general strike, this is what I'd do. Because a general strike is called on something that happens, and it's got to be a combination of everything coming together at the right moment to create that one little condition that says, here it is. It happens. I don't think you could plan it and have it come off effectively.
What kind of effect do you think that the general strike had on people's minds?
I think it gave the working people, the people in unions, an indication of their strength that they had if they stood together. I don't think it may have had a bearing as far as the labor legislation that came in at that time. The Taft-Hartley. It could have had an input into that because the Taft-Hartley most certainly did put a curtailment on us as far as some of our activities, some of our abilities to organize, put restrictions there that we hadn't had before. But when you say what did it do for people, I think it gave them a greater sense of power in other words, what can we do as union people? What can being in a union do for you? I think it had an impact for a while, but, memories are short. People forget. And it's like today in the younger generation, which I don't blame them a bit, I was the same way, that say, hey, look, don't remind me what happened in the past. What's going to go on today?
Many factors contributed to the general strike being an inconclusive skirmish over control of the city. the quieting of the labor front nationally, new prosperity, and the Cold War ideology added to the fact of a progressive militant trade union leadership that had nowhere else to go. This is the 30th anniversary of the Oakland General Strike, but there is no monument to the working men and women who struck for the right to organize in 1946. No doubt that there are those who would like working people to forget that strike, and also forget that even today, that power remains in the hands of a potentially united, if presently unmilitant, working class. This program was produced by Craig Gordon, Ed Schoenfeld, and Ken Russell of the New American Movement Radio Project, and Vic Rubin and Tim Reagan of the Oakland Study Group. For Bay City Blues, this is Ed Schoenfeld speaking.